All right, cue the drums.
You cannot lose games
in the NFL and still win.
You're a Major League Baseball player.
You're a Major League Baseball player.
See the baby be born.
Well, come back.
Come back.
This kid we don't even is need a gamer.
The theme anymore.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are all rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about sports. I'm just going to leave it at that, guys. It's just a podcast about sports.
That's it. That's all it is.
That's all it's ever been.
That's right. I'm Chad Matlin, an editor at 538. Those voices you hear in the studio are my erstwhile panelists, co-panelists, co-hosts. Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Hey, Chad.
538 sports writer.
Hi, what's Neil. Up?
Guys, we got a live show coming up.
Exciting.
Wow, very exciting.
Where are we going to embarrass ourselves?
I don't know. You're
more so audience? Than usual.
Yes. Right.
I plan to be very suave, very smooth, very well spoken.
Oh, really?
You can stammer.
So you're just
going to
completely change?
The heck. It is Friday, March 11th at the Sloan Conference, 4:30. For those of you at Sloan, please stop by. For those of you not at Sloan, I'm not quite sure if you can come yet. I don't think we'll be able to sneak you past security, but let us know if you'd like to come, and we'll do our best to get you in. Email podcast at 538 if you think you might want to stop by. It's in Boston.
I'm sure it's going to be like a deluge of requests, you think?
Kate, you have no idea.
You don't even know.
The hot take heads.
And the kind of pull we have, we can just send over a guest list, and we'll
right,
be able to
exactly.
Let people in. These seven people.
We'll have a hot takedown stamp that goes on their palms.
Yes.
Know?
I thought we would just kind of like distract the security guard, and then they could like run while he's not looking. That was my plan.
Not
we'll
that well thought out,
to be honest.
We'll
that's
that
how I'm going to get in, at least.
All right. On today's show, we will travel to the border and good-naturedly give Canada a hug. None of its NHL teams are likely to make the playoffs, and Canadian teams have not won a Stanley Cup in 20 years. Are Canadian teams unlucky or just bad? Then we'll talk about NASCAR, I think, for the first time. Is that right, Neil?
Yeah, it's a marquee moment for us.
And for NASCAR fans.
And for NASCAR.
Hot townwide. Yeah. David Smith of Motorsports Analytics will join us to talk about Denny Hamlin's narrow win of the Daytona 500, the state of NASCAR stats, and whether the Daytona 500 is a test of skill or an anomaly. Hard word to say when you're a podcast host. An anomaly that encourages random results. And finally, we will return to the NBA, where Anthony Davis made our eyes pop with a 59.20 rebound game. Davis is too young for it to have been a vintage Anthony Davis game, but it was a vintage NBA game. Neil will explain why.
That's true.
That will happen.
That will happen.
That's going to all of that
on
will
Hot Takedown.
Happen.
All of that and more. With glowing hearts, sorry.
You know the Canadian anthem?
Wow.
Oh, of course I know the Canadian anthem.
What do you mean, of course?
Yeah, of course.
I've been to enough hockey games in my day, and I went to a Blue Jays game at Yankee Stadium last year and sang the anthem proudly.
I
too have been to games in Toronto, and I do not know the Canadian national anthem.
How? What percentage of the anthem do you think you know?
Oh, I know all of it.
Because you've been to a few of these games?
I was a hockey fan growing up, very, very major hockey fan when I was about 10 years old.
Well, you,
so your capacity
then.
For trivia extends to anthems?
Not just that anthem. If you can call it trivia, I mean, they're our neighbor to the north that we should know.
That is respectful of you.
As good Americans, we should know the lyrics to the
this
Canadian
is the most,
anthem.
This is the most insight I've gotten into Neil, I think, in months. Well, but my intro was going to start "Oh Canada," but I think no. you've told us that that was being cheap. That we should respect Canada and not just make a joke out of them. But
no, you can make a joke. Whoa, Canada! No, Canada! Hey, you know, hey, it's good. All of that.
So, Canada, you supply nearly half of the players in the NHL, but you win so few of the Stanley Cups. No Canadian team, at least lately, no Canadian team has won it all since 1993, and arguably only the Canucks have been competitive since, with, you know, here and there some good teams, but the Canucks are the team that in Canada that have had continued success. Seven of the nine teams least likely to make the playoffs this year are from Canada, according to various simulations on various websites that end in hyphen reference, like Hockey Reference. And no team seems likely to get there this year. That would be the first time that no Canadian team made the playoffs since 1945. Guys, what's wrong with Canada?
Neil, tell us what's wrong with Canada.
Well,
since you know Canada.
yes, I've kind of set myself up as this self-anointed expert now. I mean, if you look, so first of all, just establishing this, you know, the playoff, the possibility, strong possibility that they won't make the playoffs is pretty staggering. You said, you know, first time since 1945. Last year, they had 71% of the Canadian team. So five out of the seven Canadian teams made the playoffs. And this year, very likely that zero will make it. And we really haven't seen, they've been consistently around about 50% of the Canadian teams making the playoffs in any given year over the past, you know, two plus decades. The only time they really came close to a kind of laying an egg like this, it was in 2014, which 3 years ago they only had one playoff team out of the seven. But aside from that, it's usually half of the Canadian teams or more making the playoffs. So this is kind of an unprecedentedly bad crop of Canadian teams this year.
Well, the Nate Silver of Nate Silvers wrote an article in 2013 trying to understand why the no Canadian team had won, and at that point it was 20 years. It was the 20-year anniversary. I don't know if that sounds like it should be a positive anniversary, but and he made some, like he brought up some interesting ideas within that about one that at crucial points the Canadian dollar was really weak and perhaps that hurt the clubs and
because the players didn't want to go and play for the Canadian teams,
right? And then also using like Google search metrics within each, which was fascinating, within each city, trying to break down by percentage how many people within the city were actually avid NHL fans. And of course, the Canadian cities were by far more invested in NHL and hockey than a lot of the NHL cities to the south.
Right. And that's an argument that they should like have more of them.
You would think. But then, you know, Nate was trying to point out that perhaps there's less incentive for Canadian teams to win titles and excel because their arenas are full no matter what and their fan base is rabid and invested no matter what. And so there was all, like, Nate was offering all of these, like, slight reasons, but, like he even said in the article, you know, he's like, well, really, maybe it's just, you know, it's just luck because none of these really add up. So, I mean, can you really even be like, this is luck? Because whatever the percentage chance of it happening was like 99.7% that they should have won.
A team winning the Stanley
that
Cup.
That by now a Canadian now. Team should have won
the
Stanley
Cup. Yeah, I
have
Cup. It in front of me. The chance of Canada failing to have won a Stanley Cup in that 20-year time span that Kate's talking about was just 0.8%.
Because like even the argument that like, well, the fan bases are so incentivized and rabid, therefore the team doesn't need to be good. I mean, you even look at cities that love are like the Dallas Cowboys. They love that. Like Dallas still is incentivized to be good. So like that logic doesn't totally hold up. So do you have any sense of whether maybe it really is just luck?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so much of hockey does kind of revolve around debates over, you know, is it luck, is it skill or whatever. But I think, you know, when you're looking at odds like that, it definitely seems astronomical to say, you know, to blame all of it on luck. And Nate even took into account the quality of the Canadian teams. And one thing I was going to say just in pertaining to this year as a whole, the Canadian teams aren't very good and they have almost uniformly gotten bad since last year. And last year was a good year for them, like, you know, five out of seven made the playoffs. But they've gotten bad in areas that sort of you can chalk up to maybe they were lucky last year and that luck has sort of gone almost all the way in the opposite direction, like goaltending, for instance. A lot of the way in which Canadian teams had sort of built up how good they were last year was through these incredible goaltending performances. Carey Price of the Canadiens had one of the best all-time goaltending seasons by anyone ever last year. So you kind of knew that he might take a step backwards and he's been hurt and, you know, they really haven't been able to replace that level of production. But if you look like almost across the board, the Canadian teams have gotten worse goaltending. And I even looked at sort of tried to break down the changes year over year for each of the Canadian teams and sort of where it's coming from. Is it coming from, the, you know, they lost a lot of players, the players that they already had started playing worse. And a lot of it boils down to that last category of, you know, existing players playing worse and specifically goaltenders playing worse. If you look at the 10, you know, players that are on the same team as they were last year but have regressed the most in terms of their production according to Hockey References point shares, you'll find that first of all, almost all of those players are goalies, and that speaks to a larger point of goalies tend to be the most valuable, and they also tend to be the least valuable mm-hmm. players in the league in terms of if you just give them credit for their job, which is stopping pucks from going in the net as a percentage of opposing shots. But there's so much in the, you know, the ability to do that that is inconsistent from year to year. So it's like the most valuable thing when your goalie goes on a Carey Price-esque tear in a season, and it's also, you know, very unlikely to last going forward.
So it seems like there is some feasible explanation for this year of why the Canadians aren't good, but I want to get back to this decade,
this drought.
Several decade-long drought. So, Neil, in the past you wrote, you've written about championship droughts, but you've done it for the city of Cleveland.
That was Cleveland, yeah.
And you wrote that actually when you look at Cleveland over history, the fact that Cleveland hasn't won, I forget in how long, isn't that shocking.
I think it's 50 years as of this past year, so they might be working on 50.
So I might be wrong about your thesis, and please correct me if that's the case, but you wrote that they won, their championships came bunched up. All, I think, in the early 20th century. And so when you look zoom out and look at it from a century-long perspective, then it's not that crazy that Cleveland hasn't won in 50-something years, because and God doesn't hate Cleveland, I think, was the title on that. And so my question is, could you do the same for Canada? Like, we're seeing a several decade long drought, right? But like, our Canadians, exactly. Were they bunched up? I don't know. You probably don't have these numbers in front of you. I've just thought of this question off the top of my head.
Yeah, no,
but
Montreal winning so many. Montreal won 24 cups. No one has even won more. No one else has won more than 13. I want to say so. The most, and that's the Maple Leafs are the second winningest cup team. But also, I mean, it's important to note that during most of those teams piling up those numbers, that there were only six teams in the NHL for a long period of time up until 1968. And, you know, the Canadiens and the Maple Leafs were 2/6 of those teams. And now they're down to about, you know, 25% or less of the league is Canadian.
Yeah.
So they have a less of an opportunity each season if you just sort of assigned, you know, a random probability to each team based on where they're located. But at the same time, Nate's article sort of also accounted for that and said, you know, it's very unlikely that if you just sort of gave every team an equal chance and took into account the fact that there aren't that many Canadian teams, there still is a pretty high likelihood that somewhere in that 20 plus year period, one of them would have broken through and won by chance alone. So I don't think you can explain it by chance. I think the Canadian teams tend to, as a rule, be on average weaker than the average NHL team. Not that much weaker, but you know, enough perhaps to impact these results. And they don't tend to have these dominant teams either. And that might go into the point that he made about the fact that the Canadian dollar sort of didn't sync up well with when you were able to make the most of your buying power on the NHL market. For instance, before they had the lockout that killed the whole 2005 season, there wasn't a salary cap. You could sort of, you know, fortune favored the rich teams in the NHL, and that was right around around when the Canadian dollar was not, you know, commensurate with the U.S. dollar in terms of spending power, and it sort of stabilized since then. But then that's when you have the salary cap, and so being able to spend rampantly on players doesn't really, you know, isn't as much of an advantage. So there may be something to that in terms of the timing issue.
True, but it still doesn't explain, because it's been 10 years since the lockout,
mm-hmm.
and Canadian NHL teams tend to make more money revenue-wise than U.S. NHL teams. So why are Canadian teams slightly weaker? Because they are. If it was like points per schedule,
oh,
you know,
I mean,
per
they're
season,
definitely
like,
weaker.
They're weaker, but like it doesn't really. You would think that okay, the Canadian dollar was weak at some point, and they weren't able to capitalize on the amount of revenue and all that. But like that was so long ago at this point. Why are Canadian teams weaker?
Well, the biggest thing might just be, you know, the cyclical nature of these things. No, they try as hard as anyone. I mean, it seems it's kind of a boring answer, and it's kind of a cop-out, and for lack of a better answer, it really does seem to be cyclical. If we were having this conversation in 2004, for instance, so right before the lockout, we would have said Canada is actually sort of hasn't done this well in at least a decade and a half, if not more, and that this might be sort of a golden era for Canadian teams. And then coming right out of the lockout, you had the Edmonton Oilers make the final. And so you would have thought that that was sort of a new golden age of Canadian hockey starting, and they have tapered off since then. And so then I would hope for Canada's sake that 2016 is sort of the low point. But we saw a similar low point in the mid-90s, where the teams, you know, had been doing well in the 80s, the Edmonton Oilers with Wayne Gretzky, you know, had won many cups. And then they sort of, you know, dipped into this, you know, low period. And then they got better within the span of maybe 5-10 years. So 5 years from now, when we're still clearly going to be doing Hot Takedown, that we could revisit this conversation, and there may well be, you know, a Canadian Stanley Cup winner to talk about. It's kind of a small sample in general to look at these periods, and it is
you
tough.
Always return to the small sample.
I know.
You
I
just
know.
Always that's your
that's
cop out.
You know, that's the reflexive. You know,
there are no mysteries in this world for you, Neil. You Canadian anthem singer. You database munger. It's just all about sample size.
Yeah. Well, life is sample size, Chad.
Oh God, the game of life, the game of sample size. A new game for Nolan
Bradley.
I use
the phrase sample size 1,000 times more than I used to before I started taping.
But it's
this.
A small sample size since we started taping.
Yeah.
I don't even.
I mean, no Canadian
really, honestly,
teams have won a Stanley Cup since then.
Three times a day, I use sample size now. And before, I didn't even know. I was like, unless it was like a little mini something. I'm like, this is a sample size.
For a while.
You guys get that? Like a travel, a little sample size?
That's good. That's good.
Okay.
We'll leave it there, Kate.
All right.
To NASCAR. To the cars, guys. Last weekend, Denny Hamlin and Martin Truex Jr. emerged from a packed field to race towards the finish of the Daytona 500. Coming off the last turn, Truex was in the lead until Hamlin banked slightly higher and finished just 0.011 seconds. That's a hundredth of a second ahead of Truex for the win. It was the closest Daytona 500 ever. And here to make sense of Hamlin's victory and the role that Daytona plays in NASCAR analytics is a guy who someone once called, yes, the Nate Silver of the NASCAR world, David Smith. David, hello.
I'm not too sure about that designation, but I'm happy to be here.
Around here, David, anytime you get the Nate Silver of blank, you take it.
Yeah.
I have never been called the Nate Silver of editing, but I'm waiting. I'm waiting to be the Nate Silver of editing. Neil,
I will take it until someone comes and knocks me off the off the crown.
Excellent. All right. So, David, if I was cherry picking, I would tell you that 6 of the 10 closest Daytona 500 finishes have come since 2007. Is that meaningful that Daytona is getting closer and closer, or is it just a random mini trend?
No, actually, I believe that that is meaningful, and I think that that's the case for NASCAR as a whole. In the 50s and 60s, you had cars winning races by whole laps. You know, it's funny, fans nowadays tend to reminisce about yesteryear, about, you know, about races being races, men being men, all that good stuff, but the races weren't nearly as close. The equipment wasn't nearly as strong. The attrition rates were high. Now it's getting to be all things equal. You're seeing Crew chiefs become more intelligent. They're utilizing analytics. You're seeing college-trained engineers enter the sport. NASCAR is slowly becoming an all-equipment even Formula One. So a lot of the results that you see now are based on driver talent, and that's the cream rises to the top. I mean, the last few years, we've seen some of the sport's best win the Daytona 500, and previously that you saw a lot of flukes come to fruition. Derek Cope in 1990, Trevor Bayne only about 6 years ago. They only won a few other races outside of the Daytona 500, but now it takes not only a really good team with almost a near-perfect car, but you have to have the driving talent as well, as Sunday showed in slick handling conditions.
Now, when you say that NASCAR is using analytics, can you share with us like some examples of what that means on the inside?
Right. I don't think it's for answering the obvious questions. I do think that they're utilizing deeper cut statistics to unearth the questions they should be asking. You know, the example of this I use is a driver in the number one car, Jamie McMurray. 3 years ago was one of the worst restarters in the sport.
When you say restart, just for our non-NASCAR listeners, that's when there's the cars come off the track for whatever reason, and then the cars restart quite literally from scratch, right?
Sure. All leads and deficits are cut, and it's back to you keep the same position, but a relatively even playing field. McMurray's issue was, you know, on the spreadsheet you see that he's losing spots regularly. You have to understand how he was losing spots. He wasn't actually getting past while the green flag was out. He was conceding entire spots before taking the green flag. He felt that backing up would help him gain momentum going into the first turn when, and I'm not a physicist, so there's something about gaining momentum from a relatively resting position doesn't add up, but he for whatever reason, he felt that way. He actually learned to cut it forward and cut that position back, giving it an equal playing field across the start-finish line. Now he's a top 10 restarter, so crew chiefs are looking at things like how they can affect the race on pit road when passing is sparse. Drivers are looking at ways to gain track position without having to work as hard.
That sounds like they're using numbers to try to kind of gain an advantage in a strategic way. But are there ways that we can measure sort of like driver performance or sort of like identify, you know, who the best drivers are after accounting for certain factors?
Sure. I mean, I think you can take your pick. At motorsportsanalytics.com, I utilize a production and equal equipment rating. I call it PEER, and it measures a driver's results while using factors to remove the strength of the equipment and the personnel at his disposal.
So can you give us just a quick example of maybe a driver that headline-wise or media-wise we think is awesome, but maybe statistically says something different?
I don't know how you feel about Danica Patrick. But she's...
I feel fine about
however you tell me to feel right in this moment.
You're the expert.
Okay, so, you know, if you're a non-NASCAR fan, you're going to watch other sports. You're going to, you know, watch it. Certainly that her Super Bowl commercials come to mind for GoDaddy and other sponsors. But she's in the news quite a bit. Her Q score is, you know, probably second in the sport only to Dale Earnhardt Jr. In terms of peer, though, she is ranked last 3 out of the last 4 years among all drivers. And then the outlier year, she ranked the third worst. The equipment she has at her disposal at Stuart Haas Racing, it has a Hendrick Motorsports affiliation. You're talking about top-of-the-line motors and personnel that has, you know, championship pedigree. Most drivers would kill for the position that she has. her stature, her celebrity, has afforded an opportunity that's not available to a lot of race car drivers. She might run 15th, but it's also a car that's capable of running about 9th or 10th on any given day. She chronically underachieves, so when you see her on a commercial, she's getting a lot of the attention. She's one of NASCAR's most popular drivers, but from an actual production standpoint, she doesn't really add anything to her team. She's relying heavily on the personnel around her.
So let's get back to the race that we watched over the weekend for a second. You predicted that Dale Earnhardt Jr. was going to win, and Hamlin was second most likely to win. So you came, certainly, you know, you had I think Earnhardt Jr. finished third, so you had the right drivers in the top crew. And you did that based on crash rate or how much the predicted crash rate would be? What does...
Well, Earnhardt didn't finish third. He finished far lower. He actually crashed out.
Sorry, maybe he was third at some point throughout the race.
So what happened, what you saw at the Daytona 500 were... two convergent, two divergent paths. Denny Hamlin did everything that he had to do to win this race. His third place running position in the last 3 years, which is seven races at Daytona, third place has been in a multi-car accident zero times. So if you're going to utilize history as probability, there was a 0% chance that Denny Hamlin was going to crash running where he was. Hmm. In previous races at Daytona, Dale Jr. was very good at avoiding the middle of the draft. His average running position was about 10th. He led a lot, but he stayed out of that major fray. And I think that what you're alluding to is the Washington Post story wrote that he had a little bit better of an 18% chance using that average running position to be caught in a multi-car accident. His race took a big change when the sun came out. The entire week leading up to the Daytona 500 was about high 40s, low 50 degree temperatures.
It's the sun's fault, you're
really
saying. Blame the sun.
I blame
really
the weather.
For traction for a race car. It was about 76 to 80 degrees on Sunday, so a wild difference. He didn't have the kind of grip that he was used to. He had a race car that he was fighting, sliding around, and he couldn't maintain a high running position. So he was mired deep in the middle of the field and spun on his own accord. It wasn't a multi-car crash, but he put his car in a spot that statistically you don't need to put your car.
David, I think that we're out of time, but thanks for coming on and chatting NASCAR analytics. This has been I think long in coming for Hot Takedown. We've never quite gotten there.
Hey, thank you guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Excellent. Thanks, David. And listeners, you can read more of David's work at motorsportsanalytics.com. Games like the one Anthony Davis had on Sunday night do not come around often. The New Orleans Pelican had 59 points, 20 rebounds, and a glimmer of how good the Pelicans can be when Davis isn't injured. And yet still, it wasn't enough for some. You know, some people can never be satisfied. Here is the crew at Highly Questionable yakking about Davis's performance.
I thought that this guy was supposed to be the MVP. You guys have been praising him for years.
Yeah,
you know,
haven't.
I mean, what he did in this game is the only time that he has shown up for a game.
Not the only time, but he's not yet 23 years old. It's pretty impressive, 59 and 20.
Oh, he is too young. He is too young. He's in the NBA. Get out there and play like that every game.
Yeah, okay.
That's what you get paid for.
Right. Is this guy right? Should we be expecting every game to be like this out of Davis?
I mean, every game? 59 and 20?
Just saying.
I think it's...
got preternatural talent.
It was only
he can jump, he can rebound.
That's all you
he
need.
He can score. Just
he's got an eyebrow.
Do that.
Yeah.
Just do that more every single night.
Good segment, guys.
You see what you did the other day? Do it again.
Do that.
Do that again.
And that's the show.
Neil,
wrap it.
Tell us. How rare is this kind of performance, no matter how good you are?
Yeah, it's only happened 36 times in
and
the history of NBA.
20-plus
so
point,
getting
rebounds.
59 points and 20 rebounds or more in both categories in a single game. 33 of those were done by Wilt Chamberlain.
Heard of him.
Yeah, 17 of those were done specifically by Wilt during the 1961-62 season, which was when he averaged 50 points a game, scored 100 in a game. So we're talking like this is the output of monstrously, you know, productive NBA players and seasons.
So you're saying Anthony Davis is Wilt Chamberlain. That's what you just told us, right?
That's your hot take for this.
That's my hot take for this. And that begs the question, again, why isn't he doing it every time then? 50 points a game.
You just said that Wilt did it, basically, during the
1960s. Wilt did it all the time.
Well, he averaged that. So Anthony Davis is not trying hard enough.
Sure, just like the Canadian hockey teams. Yeah.
Well, we solved this problem.
Again, great segment, guys. So Neil, it seems like this kind of game is getting rarer and rarer as time goes on. Is it because the NBA has changed, or is it because we just don't have Wilt Chamberlain anymore?
Well, so I should say that, I mean, these types of games are just rare in general. Like the 59-20 is just going to, you know, it's almost like a black swan or something. Like,
I prefer a comet streaking
through
the sky.
Yeah, it's a comet streaking
through
the sky.
That.
Yes, that's right. Anthony Davis also enjoyed his performance.
Yes.
But, you know, in general, performances that are sort of not quite that stellar but in the same neighborhood are getting rarer. And you can see that just by, you know, looking at the frequency of games of just 50 and 20, for instance. That had only been done, this is the third time it's been done since 1983. And the previous one was Shaq and Chris Webber also did that. So, and then before that, not that many, but you also have to look at, you know, seasons in which it's remotely capable of happening. So guys averaging 20 points a game and 15 rebounds a game, for example. Kevin Love, a couple of years ago, became the first person to do that since 1983. And like 90% of the time that had been done in a season was done before the merger in 1976. So we're talking about the types of, you know, night in and night out performances that are required to sort of spawn one of these freakishly crazy point rebound combination games are just not happening as often across the league in general. And so, you know, it's going to require something even more astronomically unlike, you know, it's going to make it more unlikely when it does happen. So a game like Davis, might have had, you know, some small but still feasible percentage probability of happening in 1962, and so much less of a probability of happening in 2016.
Okay, so, and if I throw out some like reasoning for why, and then you can tell me how much of it is hot takey and how much is maybe.
Or
somewhat.
You can tell me how much of it
no,
is hot takey.
No, you know the Canadian anthem. So
anyone who knows that clearly.
Yes, I would like to. You're the oracle.
We can talk about Raptors basketball.
I mean, for like the first few things that come to mind is like one, the size of NBA players has just increased so dramatically since 1960s. So it was like before Wilt being on the court. Around the rest of NBA players, this the pure differential with which like his height and length versus everyone else he was going up against for rebounds was just dramatically different than at least the NBA that I'm watching. And as we've read, like statistically speaking, like the NBA player's size has just increased so much. And then also like the amount of NBA players who are focusing on one specific statistical category or one or two and focusing on that and also having and then correlating also having a game that is within a specific space that leads you to get 20 plus rebounds and shoot at a percentage, although we see Steph Curry be able to get 60 points even though he's shooting from the outside, shoot at a high percentage. There's just not that many players anymore who aren't also reversing the ball up top and doing the type of versatile swingman type NBA player behavior and skill set that we weren't seeing guys do, or I wasn't alive, so I wasn't seeing it at all, but that they weren't doing in like the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, and I'd be interested, I mean, just anecdotally across the whole league, it does seem like player archetypes have kind of become more specialized, so you're not going to have the scorer and the rebounder sort of be in the same package as much as in the past. So I think those I'd be actually really interested. I haven't crunched the numbers myself, sad to say, about like the concentration of scoring and rebounding in, you know, singular players instead of being sort of spread out across a bunch of different players. And maybe that's a trend that's happening more across the league as well.
And it's interesting, too, because I think teams in the NBA are more aware now that they can't have too many players that need the ball, and we talked about this in the NBA Stats School about usage rate and about, you know, what it is for a team to want the player who finishes a possession to be a player that has a high efficiency rate, that they're able to finish the possession and do it well. And so I was just reading a Zach Lowe story earlier today about whether the Warriors should try and get Kevin Durant and whether they should make some trades to do that. But if you do that, all of a sudden you have a player who needs the ball in his hands, and that takes the ball away from Curry. And our colleague Ben Morris has written that maybe the Warriors should be giving the ball more to Curry because Curry is so good. And so it strikes me that that teams are much savvier about distributing, about not having too many players that need the ball. And so you'd think that maybe that means that the number of these types of games would go up because you'd have one player that the offense keys in around, but at the same time you have this small ball orientation, which sort of cuts against it. It's a little confusing.
Yeah, I mean, it could also very well be the fact that like rule changes over the past, you know, 15 years in the NBA have really geared things toward a more perimeter-based game. So now your scorer is not packaged in the same person as your rebounder. It's more likely to be a perimeter player. And it used to be easier, you know, those possessions that were high efficiency, the answer to how do we get high efficiency possessions used to be dump it inside to right. Shaq, or before that Kareem, or, you know, even Wilt. And now the answer is spread the floor and shoot from the outside. And if you have to go inside, drive like James Harden and do everything you can to try to get fouled.
And be ready to kick a pass out to give it to somebody else.
To someone else who's open. Because of it.
An obvious thing to say also, but like the advent of the three-point line then is the huge reason why these games never happen. I mean, and that's essentially what we're saying here, because when Wilt
was... Because it spaces the floor differently?
Right, because before, outside shots didn't have the same efficiency production rate because you didn't have the extra point associated
with it.
Right,
there
was no reason to take anything. Why would you take anything past the
12-foot? Every shot was a mid-range,
It was also before Hackershack was... I don't know what the history of Hackershack is with Wilt or anything, but now for these big men that maybe could dominate someone like DeAndre Jordan, who has a great shooting percentage overall because he shoots right under the basket, or a great true shooting percentage, maybe it is, I forget, you just foul him and you take the points away that way.
Right.
Right, you know, somebody like Jordan is not as capable of just creating offense for himself. And a lot of that also, again, going to the perimeter, you know, changes to the game, the offense has to be created from the outside in now instead of sort of, you know, dumping it inside and letting someone in the post, you know, work their way through. But maybe we're missing the biggest thing since the 60s, which is the fact that the game is just like way slower paced now than it was back then. And I crunched some numbers on this. We have to estimate pace, which is possessions per game, for seasons before the 70s, because they didn't really track all of the things that go into it. But we can get an idea from, you know, shot attempts and things like that. And it's estimated that in 1962, the average team had 31% more possessions per game than they do nowadays. So if you
put up
D'Antoni's Suns, you know, we think that today's NBA
is faster. We think we're playing really fast now.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was so much faster back then.
Is that pre-shot clock?
Yeah, and there wasn't even a shot clock.
No, there was a shot clock.
But it wasn't 24.
Yeah, it was 24 back then.
It's always been... Yeah. No, I thought the NBA shot clock used to be longer.
The NBA has always had 24-second shot clocks since, I want to say, mid-50s, I want to say.
Neil we knows can look at this. Everything.
And,
and in Canada, the shot clock was still 24-second as well.
So, you know, if you score 59 and 20 rebounds in today's, you know, average environment, or in the 1960s environment, rather, if you kind of translated that to the environment of today and the possessions of today, it would only be like 45 points and 14 rebounds. Oh, I should say only. God,
only.
Terrible.
That was in
number,
quotes, everybody.
Terrible numbers there. But still, I mean, it underscores how much of a boost you get. And it should also be said that a lot of teams played a very, you know, the way to get the possession rate up so high, the pace. pace up so high back then was just immediate fast breaks, very quick shots, and not like your 7 seconds or less like Steve Nash, super efficient fast break possessions, but like, let's just go down and chuck something up and then hope to rebound it. Because if you look at the shooting percentages back then, they were terrible. League average shooting percentage in 1962 was 42.6%. This year, the league average is 45%. So they're shooting better, and they're not, you know, they're shooting slower but better, and that gives you less of an opportunity to get rebounds,
right?
Because there are fewer missed shots and less of a chance per possession, even in addition to the 31% extra.
So Anthony Davis should do this every night.
Anthony Davis should build a time machine and go back to 1962, and God help those defenders.
I'm
going to
start keeping a list of the things that make Neil's cadence really pick up because he gets overexcited about it. Canadian anthems.
Yep.
Or sorry, anthems. One. To historical NBA.
Oh, statistics. In comparative to the modern day NBA.
Yeah, exactly.
When those two are just collide, just the rate of speech.
The mouth just can't move.
I might make a charter to.
Our sample size is low on this.
We should make him wear a Fitbit or something with a pulse monitor, and we'll just see which segment spikes the most. Yeah. All right, Neil, are you comfortable leaving it there?
I feel like we've laid it to rest, but we'll probably revisit it the next time that Anthony Davis goes out and scores 70 points and 30 rebounds.
Excellent. All right, now time for some significant digit when Allison McCann brings us a number from the world of sports, a telling number from the world of sports. Allison, first of all, are you still in Argentina?
I'm still in Argentina.
Man.
Are you there for work?
I'm there forever.
Yeah, what a plum significant digit assignment.
Forever?
We sent her there, you know, to just trawl
hang out
through
the Summer analyst. Olympics.
Yeah. Allison, what have you brought this week from the faraway land?
From the faraway land, I bring a nice, good American significant digit. It is two. Two is the number 50-point games from Minnesota's Rachel Banham this month. And two is also the number of scoring records she now holds, the Big Ten career record, and she is tied for the NCAA single-game scoring record that was actually set in 1987. So, she's crushing it. She is consistently putting up 50-point games and has been shouted out by the likes of Kobe Bryant and others. And, is doing awesome. I'm sure Kate has been watching her for a long time, but I've just seen a few games now, and she's pretty incredible.
She's pretty great. And when you were referencing the Kobe tweet, when Kobe apparently was watching the Minnesota game, and Rachel hit that, like, fading to the left three-pointer to win the game for Minnesota. I mean, that was, like, as Kobe pointed out, a very difficult shot to make.
We just got done talking about how difficult it is for an NBA player to score 50-plus points and 20-plus rebounds. And here we have a WNBA player.
It could be interesting to analyze because women's basketball I hope this isn't a hot take. I don't really know for sure, but so much lower scoring, I think, than even men's college basketball, and of course lower than the NBA. So to score 50 points, I wonder what that translates to NBA
with
terms.
More pace.
Yeah, with more pace. And
yeah, and I don't know how the usage rates are distributed either. They could
because nobody does any statistical analysis of women's sports. So we don't know these things, so we're just sort of riffing.
We will someday.
But yeah, I mean, for her to score 250-plus point games, I mean, that's got to equate to like having 280-point games or something like that.
You
in
think
the
it's
NBA,
happy
right?
with multiplier.
I don't know. But also, Minnesota's had some good guards in its day because Lindsay Whalen, who's been on the Olympic team and who's a WNBA All-Star, I played against her when she was at Minnesota. They've had actually really good guards comparative to how many really good guards you'd think Minnesota Gopher women's basketball would have.
This is a lot of Minnesota for one sig big. I think this is the most Minnesota.
And then
we've ever
also
had.
We did a ton of Canada, which is kind of like Minnesota.
This is a northern show today. while Allison is in the southern hemisphere, we are doing the great north. All right, Allison, thanks very much for calling in from the other side.
And no problem. I'll be back in America for the next one.
America. Oh,
yay.
I'm sorry for you, but I'm happy for us. Thanks, Allison.
All right. Bye, guys.
All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Neil.
Hey, thanks, Chad.
Neil, you were better than okay today. I think you really brought it today.
He was between okay and decent, I thought.
Oh, yeah. You didn't think he rose above decent?
I thought that singing the words
what I'm
from the...
That's a plus.
That was. That's why he got bumped up. From
okay
plus
to decent
between the two.
Oh,
Yeah. Well, after adjusting for the equipment that I have to use
and the historical era that you're podcasting in,
and the historical pace at which I'm podcasting, we'll have to crunch the numbers.
All right, excellent. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast overlord is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Tony Chow. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. Jonathan, thank you for that prep pack. You too, Joe. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're on iTunes as well. Subscribe to itunes.com/538. Don't forget, there are two other 538 podcasts in our growing family. There's an elections podcast. There's a data, what does it mean for our life podcast. That one's called What's the Point? The former is called 538 Elections. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you are in iTunes. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.